Trend number three, the art of political warfare. For years, China and Russia have been using cyber attacks, economic coercion, disinformation, election meddling, and other tactics to disrupt and destabilize the political systems of the United States and other guardians of the international order. As a result, calls have emerged for the United States to go on the offensive, waging political warfare against China and Russia, just as they wage political warfare against the U.S. The possibility of actively waging political warfare against China and Russia is a high-stakes decision, but it's not something entirely new to the West. In fact, the United States undertook concerted political warfare campaigns designed to sow instability, division, and weakness in Eastern Europe and within the Soviet Union itself at two key points during the 20th century Cold War. One such campaign came between 1947 and the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. The other came during the presidency of Ronald Reagan. During these periods, Washington employed an array of measures, including radio broadcasts into the Soviet bloc, covert paramilitary actions, economic denial policies, human rights campaigns, and many other efforts intended to undermine communist rule and impose competitive costs on the Kremlin and its satellites. Throughout the Cold War, moreover, the United States used political warfare to harass, weaken, and overthrow Soviet-aligned governments in the Third World. All of this was in addition to U.S. and Allied efforts to resist Moscow's offensive political warfare campaigns. The history of U.S. political warfare programs during the Cold War illustrates what political warfare is and what forms it can take. It also points to possibilities for waging political warfare today. As Professor Hal Brands of Johns Hopkins explained in a recent report for the American Enterprise Institute, political warfare is not a one-size-fits-all concept. In fact, political warfare campaigns are defined by at least nine factors or dimensions, which include being 1. Offensive or defensive, 2. Overt or covert, 3. Hard or soft, 4. Catalytic or corrosive, 5. Direct or indirect, 6. Unilateral or multilateral, 7. Governmental or non-governmental, 8. Meant to restrain or meant to provoke, and 9. Part of a minimalist or maximalist strategy of competition. Understanding each of the nine dimensions of political warfare provides greater insight not only into what the United States and its allies could do, but into what our adversaries in Beijing and Moscow are likely to do. The first and most basic distinction is between offensive and defensive political warfare. Defensive efforts are meant to frustrate an adversary's political warfare initiatives and protect one's society or allies from malign influence. Offensive political warfare, by contrast, means taking the fight to the adversary by destabilizing an enemy regime, raising its costs of doing business, or otherwise undermining its ability to compete. In the 20th century, the twin goals of U.S. political warfare were holding our own world together, as well as increasing the disruptive strains in the Soviet world. Analysts have suggested various possibilities for waging offensive political warfare in today's competitions, sanctioning corrupt or repressive officials, introducing or amplifying unbiased information going into the Chinese and Russian systems, supporting advocates of internal liberalization, and even pursuing covert measures to foment instability. Critically, the goal of an offensive strategy need not be to overthrow the Chinese or Russian governments, although that could be an objective. It could simply aim to divert their attention and energy, increase domestic and diplomatic difficulties, and disadvantage them in strategic competition. The second dimension is between overt and covert activity. We often think of political warfare as something that happens in the shadows, and previous campaigns have indeed had a vital covert component. In the late 1940s, the Truman administration's defensive efforts in Italy and France involved covert support to friendly trade unions and political parties. However, political warfare can also take place in the sunshine, not just in the shadows. Ronald Reagan's rhetorical offensive against the Soviet Union in the 1980s was political warfare in that it was intended to increase the ideological pressure on Moscow and its satellites, and it was carried out entirely in public. Meanwhile, the National Endowment for Democracy supported trade unions and civil society organizations in Poland, financed opposition newspapers in Nicaragua, and otherwise worked to promote liberalization in the communist bloc. The calculation was that unembarrassed support for democratic values was itself a form of pressure. The United States could throw the competition off balance simply by standing up for its own best traditions and values. If a key goal of political warfare is to exploit the weaknesses of a competitor's regime, then initiatives that openly and forthrightly target an autocracy's worst tendencies can be particularly powerful. They can also help avoid a constant danger of covert initiatives, which is that they will be exposed and publicized, with all the blowback that follows. The third dimension is hard versus soft. Hard political warfare undermines an opponent by exerting pressure and inflicting pain. In today's competitions, initiatives might include punitive tariffs meant to weaken Chinese economic growth, or aggressive public diplomacy campaigns meant to delegitimize the Russian and Chinese regimes at home and abroad. Meanwhile, soft political warfare can weaken opponents not by directly confronting or pressuring them, but by using more creative approaches, including inducements, in order to expose and exacerbate weaknesses. The Marshall Plan, for instance, represents soft political warfare at its best. It was intended, in part, to subvert the Soviet Empire through its profoundly unorthodox approach of offering to include Moscow and its satellites in the reconstruction of Europe. As the State Department knew, this offer would confront Stalin with an impossible choice: accept Marshall Plan aid, thereby opening up Eastern Europe to Western influence, or reject it, thereby earning the enmity of populations that desperately needed reconstruction assistance. The Kremlin took the latter approach, showing the brutal, exploitive face of its hegemony in Eastern Europe and creating a legitimacy deficit that plagued it for decades. A fourth dimension depends on whether the political warfare campaign is intended to be catalytic or corrosive. The most spectacular forms of political warfare are catalytic. They are meant to trigger some dramatic near-term change. Cold War-era operations designed to bring down hostile regimes in Guatemala, Iran, and other countries fit this mold. So did some prominent U.S. propaganda initiatives. Their goal was simply to keep discontent in the Soviet bloc simmering, air the failings of the communist regimes before a larger domestic and global audience, and increase the strain on those governments over time. The catalytic versus corrosive distinction can help frame debates about how to wage political warfare against China and Russia today. Washington probably could not incite a significant near-term upheaval in either country, and trying might be quite dangerous. But America could take steps, such as creating greater awareness in Russia of Putin's corruption and the human toll of its war in Ukraine, or dredging up reminders of Tiananmen Square and other crimes of the Chinese Communist Party that could potentially challenge these regimes' legitimacy over time. Successful political warfare does not necessarily involve stimulating outright revolt. It can simply entail pursuing policies that gradually and cumulatively erode the foundations and sap the competitive potential of a hostile regime. The fifth dimension of political warfare is direct versus indirect. Some political warfare takes dead aim at one's rival. Covert destabilization activities, support for anti-government dissidents, and other such measures seek to weaken or impose costs on authoritarian regimes by directly targeting their weaknesses. But political warfare can also be indirect. It can attack authoritarian regimes by shaping the broader global milieu. The late Cold War provides a good example. During the late 1970s and 1980s, the Carter and Reagan administrations undertook an array of initiatives promoting human rights and democracy in countries worldwide, and sponsoring covert action programs against communist regimes in Afghanistan and Nicaragua that did not directly challenge the stability of the Soviet political system. The relevant contemporary parallel might be efforts to strengthen democracy in the Russian and Chinese near abroad. By supporting the consolidation and protection of democratic institutions in Georgia, Ukraine, and the Baltic states, the United States can challenge Putinism in Russia by providing an unflattering contrast to the Kremlin's managed democracy. by helping Taiwan maintain its sovereignty and protect its domestic institutions from Chinese meddling, the United States can challenge Beijing's narrative that political democracy and traditional Chinese values cannot successfully coexist. In political warfare, as in strategy, much can be said for the indirect approach. The sixth dimension of political warfare is unilateral versus multilateral. The United States undertakes some political warfare initiatives alone. Many, but not all, covert operations against Soviet satellites in Eastern Europe and the Third World were carried out unilaterally, as were many covert and overt propaganda activities. The downside of unilateral efforts is that they may not have as much effect as a more broadly coordinated campaign. They may also unnerve or even alienate allies that see U.S. policy as excessively proactive. As a result, Cold War-era administrations often attempted a multilateral approach. Throughout the Cold War, NATO members worked more or less effectively to coordinate their approaches to trading with the enemy. During the early Cold War and again in the 1980s, for instance, the United States pushed its allies to undertake multilateral economic warfare campaigns against Moscow in hopes of weakening the Kremlin's economic potential and straining its relationships with Eastern European satellites. U.S. officials will confront similar trade-offs in the coming years. The more Washington perceives a need to pursue forward-leaning, covert political warfare initiatives against Beijing and Moscow, the greater the temptation to pursue them unilaterally. But the broader and more multilateral those initiatives are, the greater the effect they are likely to have. The seventh dimension of political warfare is governmental versus non-governmental. Like most aspects of U.S. foreign policy, political warfare is normally conducted by official or quasi-official state organs, including the CIA, State Department, and National Endowment for Democracy. Political warfare, however, can also be a non-governmental affair. In the last decade of the Cold War, the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, or AFL-CIO, subverted the Soviet bloc by supporting organized labor and civil disobedience in Poland. Non-governmental actors have also played prominent roles in defensive political warfare. In recent years, cybersecurity firms and independent experts in the United States and other Western countries have exposed malign Russian internet activity. For U.S. rivals, non-governmental actors can often be dangerous and implacable enemies. The eighth dimension of political warfare is provoke versus restrain. Political warfare initiatives differ in the reaction they aim to elicit. Political warfare can restrain an adversary by, for example, dissuading an authoritarian government from repressing its population by imposing economic sanctions or simply publicizing its crimes. In the same vein, Magnitsky Act sanctions against Russian officials involved in human rights abuses, or congressional proposals to sanction Chinese officials involved in repressing that country's Uyghur minority, can be seen as efforts to restrain rival regimes by raising the costs of autocratic behavior. Conversely, political warfare can aim to provoke an adversary into doing something self-defeating. As U.S.-China competition becomes a struggle for global hearts and minds in the coming decades, America could conceivably benefit from pursuing hypothetical policies supporting separatists in Tibet or Xinjiang, which are meant to provoke the Chinese government into a repressive response that would discredit Beijing in the eyes of the world. The morality of this approach is, of course, incredibly fraught. Policymakers who wage political warfare in hopes of provoking an authoritarian regime need to understand that success may come at a horrible cost for those who live under the autocrat's boot. Finally, the ninth dimension of political warfare is minimalist versus maximalist. Political warfare initiatives can vary in how they fit into a country's larger strategy because the political warfare is usually relatively low cost. For instance, when the Truman administration was determined to hold military expenditures down in the late 1940s, it waged the Cold War primarily through non-military tools and political warfare methods that were seen as affordable ways of holding the line and selectively exerting pressure on the enemy. However, while political warfare can certainly be part of a minimalist poor man strategy, it can also be part of a more maximalist rich man strategy. During the 1980s, the Reagan administration's political warfare campaign was one piece of a multi-pronged geopolitical offensive that included a major military buildup and enhanced competition in the Third World. The goal was not simply to hold the line, but to maximize the strain on the Soviets as a prelude to winding down the Cold War on American terms. Political warfare initiatives could fit into both minimalist and maximalist strategies today. If the United States resolves to devote the lion's share of its resources to competing with China, then political warfare could be part of a cost-conscious strategy for imposing costs on Moscow and other rivals, such as Iran. Alternatively, a more ambitious approach might use political warfare methods as part of a multi-front pressure strategy aimed at rolling back Chinese and Russian influence overseas and perhaps even weakening their regimes at home. So, what's the bottom line? Political warfare will remain at the center of foreign policy debates in the coming years, as U.S. rivalries with China and Russia deepen and American officials look to gain a competitive edge. Given this trend, we offer the following forecasts for your consideration. First, China, Russia, and Iran will use every tool at their disposal to influence the 2020 elections and shape U.S. policies. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence has declared that exposing and thwarting these efforts are its top short-term priority. Second, in the weeks and months ahead, the United States will explicitly reverse accommodationist policies vis-à-vis China that were put in place by prior administrations. In a recent policy speech, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made clear that our past approach has failed, and he clearly stated that the Trump administration's China policy was to induce a change of behaviors by the CCP. The administration wants to achieve this goal in two steps at the same time. The first step involves becoming very confrontational with the CCP in terms of trade negotiations, charges of espionage, visa policy, and the closure of consulates. By doing so, the United States basically matches the intensity of China's aggressiveness. The second step will involve meeting with China at the negotiating table on various major issues. At that point, the United States will make clear that, unlike past U.S. administrations, it is willing to bear the cost of a confrontation with China. This 1-2 punch will make it clear to both friend and foe that it's no longer business as usual with China. Third, the recent change in leadership at the United States Agency for Global Media, or USAGM, will enable it to return to its traditional role as an instrument of political warfare. In recent years, this organization, which includes Radio Free Europe and the Voice of America, has become just another media organization that happened to broadcast in a huge array of languages. To return the USGM to its original mission of promoting the policies and principles of the United States around the world, the president appointed Michael Pack as the new CEO. Initially, Pack ruffled a lot of feathers when he quickly removed all of his direct reports. However, his efforts represent an important first step in returning USAGM to the valid role of shaping global opinion in the service of America's political warfare objectives. Fourth, because China is so integrated into the global economy, the U.S. will focus on tariffs and other hard economic warfare options to create maximum pain. China's economy is very dependent on exports of manufactured goods and imports of food and energy. Squeezing Chinese companies out of global export and capital markets will seriously constrain China's affluence and ability to fund a massive military expansion. And escalating reprisals against its neighbors will be met with even stronger sanctions by the U.S.-led alliance. And fifth, the U.K. will extend provisional citizenship to Hong Kong residents, enabling up to 3 million to leave China. Given the high educational attainment of Hong Kongers, this brain drain will have a disproportionate impact on the Chinese economy. Meanwhile, the arrival of these high-value English-speaking immigrants will be a boon to the economy of Taiwan, as well as countries across the Anglosphere. More importantly, this exodus will represent a major public relations black eye for China, solidifying its status as a pariah nation. It will either have to watch as these people depart, give them sufficient incentive to stay, or effectively imprison them within China, bringing even more international sanctions. None of these options are appealing.